I checked the peep before opening it and was relieved to see it was my ex-wife with Harry Bosch standing right behind her. But that relief was short-lived. The moment I turned the knob, they pushed in, and I could immediately feel a bad energy enter with them. "We've got a problem," Maggie said. "What's wrong?" I asked. "What's wrong is that Jessup camped outside my house this morning," Bosch said. "And I want to know how he found it and what the hell he's doing." He came up close to me when he said it. I didn't know which was worse, his breath or the accusatory tone of his words. I wasn't sure what he was thinking, but I realized all the bad energy was coming from him. I stepped back from him. "Haley's still asleep. Let me just go close her bedroom door. There's fresh decaf in the kitchen, and I can brew some fully leaded if you need it." I went down the hall and checked on my daughter. She was still down. I closed the door and hoped the voices that were bound to get loud would not wake her. My two visitors were still standing when I got back to the living room. Neither had gone for coffee. Bosch was silhouetted by the big picture window that looked out upon the city, the view that made me buy the house. I could see streaks of light entering the sky behind his shoulders. "No coffee?" They just stared at me. "Okay, let's sit down and talk about this." I gestured toward the couch and chairs, but Bosch seemed frozen in his stance. "Come on, let's figure it out." I walked past them and sat down in the chair by the window. Finally, Bosch started to move. He sat down on the couch next to Haley's school backpack. Maggie took the other chair. She spoke first. "I've been trying to convince Harry that we didn't put his home address on the witness list."
"Absolutely not. We gave no personal addresses in discovery. For you, I listed two addresses, your office and mine. I even gave the general number for the PAB. Didn't even give a direct line."
"Then how did he find my house?" Bosch asked, the accusatory tone still in his voice.
"Look, Harry, you're blaming me for something I had nothing to do with. I don't know how he found your house, but it couldn't have been that hard. I mean, come on, anybody can find anybody on the internet. You own your house, right? You pay property taxes, have utility accounts, and I bet you're even registered to vote. Republican, I'm sure."
"Independent."
"Fine. The point is, people can find you if they want. Added to that, you have a singular name. All anybody would have to do is punch in,
'You gave them my full name?'"
"I had to. It's what's required, and what's been given in discovery for every trial you've ever testified in." "It doesn't matter. All Jessup needed was access to the internet, and he could have—"
"Jessup's been in prison for 24 years. He knows less about the internet than I do. He had to have help, and I'm betting it came from Royce."
"Look, we don't know that." Bosch looked pointedly at me, a darkness crossing his eyes.
"You're defending him now?"
"No, I'm not defending anybody. I'm just saying we shouldn't rush to any conclusions here. Jessup's got a roommate and is a minor celebrity. Celebrities get people to do things for them, okay? So why don't you calm down and let's back up a little bit. Tell me what happened at your house."
Bosch seemed to take it down a notch, but he was still anything but calm. I half expected him to get up and take a swing at a lamp or punch a hole in a wall. Thankfully, Maggie was the one who told the story.
"We were with the SIS watching him. We thought he was going to go up to one of the parks he's been visiting. Instead, he drove right by the mall and kept going on Mulholland. When we got to Harry's street, we had to hang back so he wouldn't see us. The SIS has a bike car. Two of them saddled up and rode down. They found Jessup sitting in his car in front of Harry's house."
"God damn it," Bosch said. "I have my daughter living with me. If this prick is—"
"Harry, not so loud, and watch what you say," I said. "My daughter's on the other side of that wall. Now please, go back to the story. What did Jessup do?"
Bosch hesitated. Maggie didn't.
He just sat there, Maggie said, for about a half hour. And he lit a candle.
A candle? In the car?
Yeah, on the dashboard.
What the hell does that mean?
Who knows?
Bosch couldn't remain sitting. He jumped up from the couch and started pacing.
And after a half hour, he drove off and went home, Maggie said. That was it. We just came from Venice.
Now I stood up and started to pace, but in a pattern clear of Bosch's orbit. Okay, let's think about this. Let's think about what he was doing.
No shit, Sherlock, Bosch said. That's the question.
I nodded. I had that coming.
Is there any reason to think that he knows or suspects he's being followed? I asked.
No, no way, Bosch said immediately.
Wait a minute, not so fast on that, Maggie said. I've been thinking about it. There was a near miss earlier in the night, you remember, Harry, on Breeze Avenue?
Bosch nodded. Maggie explained it to me.
They thought they lost him on a walk street in Venice. The lieutenant sent a guy in with a pizza box. Jessup came out from between two houses after taking a leak. It was a close call.
I spread my hands.
Well, maybe that was it. Maybe that planted suspicion and he decided to see if he was being followed.
You show up outside the lead investigator's house, and it's a good way to draw out the flies if you've got them on you.
You mean like a test? Bosch asked.
Exactly. Nobody approached him out there, right?
No, we left him alone, Maggie said. If he had gotten out of his car, I think it would have been a different story.
I nodded. Okay, so it was either a test, or he's got something planned.
In that case, it would have been a reconnaissance mission. He wanted to see where you live.
Bosch stopped and stared out the window. The sky was fully lit now.
But one thing you have to keep in mind is that what he did was not illegal, I said. It's a public street, and the OR put no restrictions on travel within Los Angeles County. So no matter what he was up to, it's a good thing you didn't stop him and reveal yourself.
Bosch stayed at the window, his back to us. I didn't know what he was thinking.
Harry, I said, I know your concerns, and I agree with them. But we can't let this be a distraction. The trial is coming up quick, and we have work to do. If we convict this guy, he goes away forever, and it won't matter if he knows where you live.
So what do I do till then? Sit on my front porch every night with a shotgun?
The SIS is on him 24/7, right? Maggie said. Do you trust them?
Bosch didn't answer for a long moment.
They won't lose him, he finally said.
Maggie looked at me, and I could see the concern in her eyes. Each of us had a daughter. It would be hard to put your trust in anybody else, even an elite surveillance squad. I thought for a moment about something I had been considering since the conversation began.
What about you moving in here, with your daughter? She can use Haley's room because Haley's going back to her mother's today, and you can use the office. It's got a sleeper sofa that I've spent more than a few nights on. It's actually comfortable.
Bosch turned from the window and looked at me.
What? Stay here through the whole trial?
Why not? Our daughters will finally get a chance to meet when Haley comes over.
It's a good idea, Maggie said.
I didn't know if she was referring to the daughters' meeting or the idea of Bosch and child staying with me.
And look, I'm here every night, I said. If you have to go out with the SIS, I got you covered with your daughter, especially when Haley's here.
Bosch thought about it for a few moments, but then shook his head.
I can't do that, he said.
Why not? I asked.
Because it's my house, my home. I'm not going to run from this guy. He's going to run from me.
What about your daughter? Maggie asked.
I'll take care of my daughter.
Harry, think about it, she said. Think about your daughter. You don't want her in harm's way.
Look, if Jessup has my address, then he probably has this address too. Moving in here isn't the answer. It's just running from him. Maybe that's his test, to see what I do. So I'm not doing anything. I'm not moving. I've got the SIS, and if he comes back and so much as crosses the curb out front, I'll be waiting for him.
I don't like this, Maggie said. I thought about what Bosch had said about Jessup having my address. Neither do I said.
Chapter 24. Wednesday, March 31st, 9 a.m. Bosch didn't need to be in court. In fact, he wouldn't be needed until after jury selection and the actual trial began. But he wanted to get a close look at the man he had been shadowing from a distance with the SIS. He wanted to see if Jessup would show any reaction to seeing him in return. It had been a month and a half since they had spent the long day in the car driving down from San Quentin. Bosch felt the need to get closer than the surveillance allowed him to. It would help him keep the fire burning. It was billed as a status conference. The judge wanted to deal with all final motions and issues before beginning jury selection the next day and then moving seamlessly into the trial. There were scheduling and jury issues to discuss, and each side's list of exhibits were to be handed in as well. The prosecution team was locked and loaded. In the last 2 weeks, Holler and McPherson had sharpened and streamlined the case, run through mock witness examinations, and reconsidered every piece of evidence. They had carefully choreographed the ways in which they would bring the 24-year-old evidence forward. They were ready. The bow had been pulled taut, and the arrow was ready to fly. Even the decision on the death penalty had been made, or rather, announced. Holler had officially withdrawn it, even though Bosch assumed all along that his use of it to threaten Jessup had merely been a pose. He was a defense attorney by nature, and there was no getting him across that line. A conviction on the charges would bring Jessup a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole, and that would have to be enough justice for Melissa Landy. Bosch was ready as well. He had diligently reinvestigated the case and located the witnesses who would be called to testify. All the while, he was still out riding with the SIS as often as possible. Nights that his daughter stayed at the homes of friends or with Sue Bambrow, the assistant principal. He was prepared for his part and had helped Holler and McPherson get ready for theirs. Confidence was high, and that was another reason for Bosch to be in the courtroom. He wanted to see this thing get started. Judge Brightman entered, and the courtroom was brought to order at a few minutes after 9. Bosch was in a chair against the railing, directly behind the prosecution table where Holler and McPherson sat side by side. They had told him to pull the chair up to the table, but Harry wanted to hang back. He wanted to be able to watch Jessup from behind. And besides, there was too much anxiety coming from the two prosecutors. The judge was going to make a ruling on whether Sarah Ann Gleason would be allowed to testify against Jessup. As Holler had said the night before, nothing else mattered. If they lost Sarah as a witness, they would surely lose the case.
On the record with California versus Jessup again, the judge said upon taking the bench. Good morning to all.
After a chorus of good mornings fired back to her, the judge got right down to business.
Tomorrow, we begin jury selection in this case, and then we proceed to trial. Therefore, today is the day that we're going to clean out the garage, so to speak, so that we can finally bring the car in. Any last motions, any pending motions, anything anybody wants to talk about in regards to exhibits or evidence or anything else, now is the time. We have a number of motions pending, and I will get to them first. First, the prosecution's request to redress the issue of the defendant's use of makeup to cover certain body tattoos is dismissed.
We argued that at length already, and I do not see the need to go at it further.
Bosch checked Jessup. He was at a sharp angle to him, so he could not see the defendant's face. But he did see Jessup nod his head in approval of the judge's first ruling of the day. Brightman then went through a housekeeping list of minor motions from both sides. She seemed to want to accommodate all, so neither side emerged as a clear favorite. Bosch saw that McPherson was meticulously keeping notes on each decision on a yellow legal pad. It was all part of the build-up to the ruling of the day. Since Sarah was to be McPherson's witness to question during trial, she had handled the oral arguments on the defense motion 2 days earlier. Though Bosch had not attended that meeting, Holler had told him that Maggie had held forth for nearly an hour in a well-prepared response to the motion to disqualify. She had then backed it with an 18-page written response. The prosecution team was confident in the argument, but neither member of the team knew Brightman well enough to be confident in how she would rule. "Now," the judge said, "we come to the defense motion to disqualify Sarah Ann Gleason as a witness for the prosecution. The question has been argued and submitted by both sides, and the court is ready to make a ruling." "Your Honor, could I be heard?" Royce said, standing up at the defense table. "Mr. Royce," the judge said, "I don't see the need for further argument. You made the motion, and I allowed you to respond to the prosecution's submission. What more needs to be said?"
"Yes, Your Honor."
Royce sat back down, leaving whatever he was going to add to his attack on Sarah Gleason a secret.
"The defense's motion is dismissed," the judge said immediately. "I will be allowing the defense wide latitude in its examination of the prosecution's witness, as well as in the production of its own witnesses to address Miss Gleason's credibility before the jury. But I believe that this witness's credibility and reliability is indeed something that jurors will need to decide."
A momentary silence enveloped the courtroom, as if everyone collectively had drawn in a breath. No response followed from either the prosecution or defense tables. It was another down-the-middle ruling, Bosch knew, and both sides were probably pleased to have gotten something. Gleason would be allowed to testify, so the prosecution's case was secured. But the judge was going to let Royce go after her with all he had. It would come down to whether Sarah was strong enough to take it.
"Now, I would like to move on," the judge said. "Let's talk about jury selection and scheduling first, and then we'll get to the exhibits."
The judge proceeded to outline how she wanted voir dire to proceed. Though each side would be allowed to question prospective jurors, she said she would strictly limit the time for each side. She wanted to start a momentum that would carry into the trial. She also limited each side to only 12 peremptory challenges, juror rejections without cause, and said she wanted to pick 6 alternates because it was her practice to be quick with a hook on jurors who misbehaved, were chronically late, or had the audacity to fall asleep during testimony.
"I like a good supply of alternates because we usually need them," she said.
The low number of peremptory challenges and the high number of alternates brought objections from both the prosecution and the defense. The judge grudgingly gave each side 2 more challenges, but warned that she would not allow voir dire to get bogged down.
"I want jury selection completed by the end of the day Friday. If you slow me down, then I will slow you down. I will hold the panel and every lawyer in here until Friday night if I have to. I want opening statements first thing Monday. Any objection to that?"
Both sides seemed properly cowed by the judge. She was clearly exerting command of her own courtroom. She next outlined the trial schedule, stating that testimony would begin each morning at 9 sharp and continue until 5, with a 90-minute lunch and morning and afternoon breaks of 15 minutes each.
"That leaves a solid 6 hours a day of testimony," she said. "Any more, and I find the jurors start losing interest. So I keep it to 6 a day. It will be up to you to be in here and ready to go each morning when I step through the door at 9. Any questions?"
There were none.
Brightman then asked each side for estimates on how long their case would take to present. Haller said he would need no more than 4 days, depending on the length of the cross-examinations of his witnesses. This was already a shot directed at Royce and his plans to attack Sarah Ann Gleason. For his part, Royce said he needed only 2 days. The judge then did her own math, adding 4 and 2, and coming up with 5. Well, I'm thinking an hour each for opening statements on Monday morning. I think that means we'll finish Friday afternoon and go right to closing arguments the following Monday. Neither side objected to her math. The point was clear. Keep it moving. Find ways to cut time. Of course, a trial was a fluid thing, and there were many unknowns. Neither side would be held to what was said at this hearing, but each lawyer knew that there might be consequences from the judge if they didn't keep a continuous velocity to their presentations. Finally, we come to exhibits and electronics, Brightman said. I trust that everyone has looked over each other's lists. Any objections to these? Both Haller and Royce stood up. The judge nodded at Royce. You first, Mr. Royce. Yes, Judge. The defense has an objection to the prosecution's plans to project numerous images of Melissa Landy's body on the courtroom's overhead screens. This practice is not only barbaric, but exploitative and prejudicial. The judge swiveled in her seat and looked at Haller, who was still standing. Your Honor, it is the prosecution's duty to produce the body, to show the crime that brings us here. The last thing we want to do is be exploitative or prejudicial. I will grant Mr. Royce that it is a fine line, but we do not plan to step across it. Royce came back with one more shot. This case is 24 years old. In 1986, there were no overhead screens, none of this Hollywood stuff. I think it infringes on my client's right to a fair trial. Haller was ready with his own comeback. The age of the case has nothing to do with this issue, but the defense is perfectly willing to present these exhibits the way they would have. McPherson had grabbed his sleeve to interrupt him. He bent down and she whispered in his ear. He then quickly straightened up. Excuse me, Your Honor, I misspoke. The prosecution is more than willing to present these exhibits in the manner they would have been presented to the jury in 1986. We would be happy to hand out color photographs to the jurors. But in earlier conversation, the court indicated that she did not like this practice. Yes, I find that handing these sorts of photos directly to the jurors to be possibly more exploitative and prejudicial, Brightman said. Is that what you wish, Mr. Royce? Royce had walked himself into a jam. No, Judge, I would agree with the court on this point. The defense was simply trying to limit the scope and use of these photographs. Mr. Haller lists more than 30 photographs that he wants to put on the big screen. It seems over the top. That is all. Judge Brightman, these are photographs of the body in the place it was found, as well as during autopsy. Each one is Mr. Haller, the judge intoned. Let me just stop you right there. Crime scene photographs are acceptable, as long as they come with appropriate foundation and testimony. But I see no need to show our jurors this poor girl's autopsy shots. We're not going to do that. Yes, Your Honor, Haller said. He remained standing, while Royce sat down with his partial victory. Brightman spoke while writing something. And you have an objection to Mr. Royce's exhibit list, Mr. Haller? Yes, Your Honor. The defense has a variety of drug paraphernalia alleged to have once been owned by Miss Gleason on its exhibit list. It also lists photos and videos of Miss Gleason. The prosecution has not been given the opportunity to examine these materials, but we believe they only go to the point that we will be conceding at trial and eliciting indirect examination of this witness. That is, that at one time in her life she used drugs on a regular basis. We do not see the need to show photos of her using drugs or the pipes through which she ingested drugs. It's inflammatory and prejudicial. It is not needed based on the concessions of the prosecution. Royce stood back up and was ready to go. The judge gave him the floor. Judge, These exhibits are vitally important to the defense case. The prosecution of Mr. Jessup hinges on the testimony of a longtime drug addict who cannot be relied upon to remember the truth, let alone tell it. These exhibits will help the jury understand the depth and breadth of this witness's use of illegal substances over a lengthy period of time. Royce was finished, but the judge was silent as she studied the defense exhibit list. All right, she finally said, putting the document aside. You both make cogent arguments. So what we are going to do is take these exhibits one at a time. When the defense would like to proffer an exhibit, we will discuss it first out of earshot of the jury. I'll make a decision then. The lawyer sat down. Bosch almost shook his head, but didn't want to draw the judge's attention. Still, it burned him that she had not slapped the defense down on this one. 24 years after seeing her little sister abducted from the front yard, Sarah Ann Gleason was willing to testify about the awful, nightmarish moment that had changed her life forever. And for her sacrifice and efforts, the judge was actually going to entertain the defense's request to attack her with the glass pipes and accoutrements she had once used to escape what she had been through. It didn't seem fair to Bosch. It didn't seem like anything that approached justice. The hearing ended soon after that, and all parties packed their briefcases and moved through the doors of the courtroom en masse. Bosch hung back and then insinuated himself into the group right behind Jessup. He said nothing, but Jessup soon enough felt the presence behind him and turned around. He smirked when he saw it was Bosch. Well, Detective Bosch, are you following me? Should I be? Oh, you never know. How's your investigation going? You'll find out soon enough. Yes, I can't. Don't talk to him! It was Royce. He had turned and noticed. And don't you talk to him, he added, pointing a finger at Bosch. If you continue to harass him, I'll complain to the judge. Bosch held his hands out in a no-touching gesture. We're cool, counselor. Part 3. To seek a true and just verdict. Chapter 25. Monday, April 5th, 9 a.m. I watched the jury file in and take their assigned seats in the box. I watched them closely, keying on their eyes mostly, checking for how they looked at the defendant. You can learn a lot from that, a furtive glance or a strong judgmental stare. Jury selection had gone as scheduled. We went through the first panel of 90 prospective jurors in a day, but had sat only 11 after most were eliminated because of their media knowledge of the case. The second panel was just as difficult to choose from, and it wasn't until Friday evening at 5:40 that we had our final 18. I had my jury chart in front of me, and my eyes were jumping between the faces in the box and the names on my post-its, trying to memorize who was who. I already had a good handle on most of them, but I wanted the names to become second nature to me. I wanted to be able to look at them and address them as if they were friends and neighbors. The judge was on the bench and ready to go at 9 sharp. She first asked the attorneys if there was any new or unfinished business to address. Upon learning there was not, she called in the jurors. Okay, we are all here, she said. I want to thank all of the jurors and other parties for being on time. We begin the trial with opening statements from the attorneys. These are not to be construed as evidence, but merely... The judge stopped, her eyes fixed on the back row of the jury box. A woman had timidly raised her hand. The judge stared for a long moment and then checked her own seating chart before responding. Ms. Tucci, do you have a question? I checked my chart. Number 10, Carla Tucci. She was one of the jurors I had not yet committed to memory. A mousy brunette from East Hollywood. She was 32 years old, unmarried, and worked as a receptionist at a medical clinic. According to my color-coded chart,
I had her down as a juror who could be swayed by stronger personalities on the panel. This was not a bad thing. It just depended on whether those personalities were for a guilty verdict or not.
"I think I saw something I wasn't supposed to see," she said in a frightened voice.
Judge Brightman hung her head for a moment, and I knew why. She couldn't get the wheels out of the mud. We were ready to go, and now the trial would be delayed before opening statements were even in the record.
"Okay, let's try to take care of this quickly. I want the jury to stay in place. Everyone else stay in place, and Ms. Tucci and the attorneys and I will go quickly back to chambers and find out what this is about."
As we got up, I checked my jury chart. There were 6 alternates. I had 3 of them pegged as pro-prosecution, 2 in the middle, and 1 siding with the defense. If Tucci was ejected for whatever misconduct she was about to reveal, her replacement would be chosen randomly from the alternates. This meant that I had a better than even chance of seeing her replaced with a juror who was partial to the prosecution, and only a 1 in 6 chance of getting a juror who was pro-defense. As I followed the entourage into chambers, I decided that I liked my chances, and I would do what I could to have Tucci ejected from the panel. In chambers, the judge didn't even go behind her desk, perhaps hoping this was only going to be a minor question and delay. We stood in a group in the middle of her office, all except the court reporter, who sat on the edge of a side chair so she could type.
"Okay, on the record," the judge said. "Ms. Tucci, please tell us what you saw and what is bothering you."
The juror looked down at the ground and held her hands in front of her.
"I was riding on the metro this morning, and the man sitting across from me was reading the newspaper. He was holding it up, and I saw the front page. I didn't mean to look, but I saw a photo of the man on trial, and I saw the headline."
The judge nodded.
"You are talking about Jason Jessup, correct?"
"Yes."
"What newspaper?"
"I think it was the Times."
"What did the headline say, Ms. Tucci?"
"New trial, old evidence for Jessup." I hadn't seen the actual LA Times that morning, but had read the story online. Citing an unnamed source close to the prosecution, the story said the case against Jason Jessup was expected to be comprised entirely of evidence from the first trial and leaning heavily on the identification provided by the victim's sister. Kate Salters had the byline on it.
"Did you read the story, Ms. Tucci?" Brightman asked.
"No, Judge. I just saw it for a second, and when I saw his picture, I looked away. You told us not to read anything about the case. It just kind of popped up in front of me."
The judge nodded thoughtfully. "Okay, Ms. Tucci, can you step back into the hallway for a moment?"
The juror stepped out, and the judge closed the door.
"The headline tells the story, doesn't it?" she said.
She looked at Royce, and then me, seeing if either of us was going to make a motion or a suggestion. Royce said nothing. My guess was that he had juror number 10 pegged the same way that I did, but he might not have considered the leanings of the 6 alternates.
"I think the damage is done here, Judge," I said. "She knows there was a previous trial. Anybody with any basic knowledge of the court system knows they don't retry you if you get a not guilty. So she'll know Jessup went down on a guilty before. As much as that prejudices things in the prosecution's favor, I think, to be fair, she has to go."
Brightman nodded.
"Mr. Royce?"
"I would agree with Mr. Harlow's assessment of the prejudice, not his so-called desire to be fair. He simply wants her off the jury and one of those church-going alternates on it."
I smiled and shook my head. "I won't dignify that with a response. You don't want to kick her off. That's fine with me."
"But it's not counsel's choice," the judge said. She opened the door and invited the juror back in. "Ms. Tucci, thank you for your honesty. You can go back to the jury room and gather your things. You are dismissed and can report back to the juror assembly room to check with them."
Tucci hesitated.
"Does that mean..." "Yes, unfortunately you are dismissed. That headline gives you knowledge of the case you should not have. For you to know that Mr. Jessup was previously tried for these crimes is prejudicial. Therefore, I cannot keep you on the jury. You may go now."
"I'm sorry, Judge."
"Yes, so am I.
Tucci left the chambers with her shoulders slumped and with a hesitant walk of someone who has been accused of a crime. After the door closed, the judge looked at us. If nothing else, this will send the right message to the rest of the jury. We're now down to 5 alternates and we haven't even started, but we now clearly see how the media can impact our trial. I have not read this story, but I will, and if I see anyone in this room quoted in it, I'm going to be very disappointed. There are usually consequences for those who disappoint me.
Judge, Royce said, I read the story this morning and no one here is quoted by name, but it does attribute information to a source close to the prosecution. I was planning to bring this to your attention.
I shook my head.
And that's the oldest defense trick in the book. Cut a deal with a reporter to hide behind the story. A source close to the prosecution? He's sitting 4 feet across the aisle from me. That was probably close enough for the reporter.
Your Honor, Royce blurted. I had nothing to—
We're holding up the trial, Brightman said, cutting him off. Let's get back to court.
We trudged back. As we went back into the courtroom, I scanned the gallery and saw Salters, the reporter, in the second row. I quickly looked away, hoping my brief eye contact had not revealed anything. I had been her source. My goal was to manipulate the story, the scene setter, as the reporter had called it, into being something that gave the defense false confidence. I hadn't intended it as a means of changing the makeup of the jury. Back on the bench, the judge wrote something on a pad and then turned and addressed the jury, once again warning the panelists about reading the newspaper or watching television news programs. She then turned to her clerk.
Audrey, the candy bowl, please.
The clerk then took the bowl of individually wrapped sour balls off the counter in front of her desk, dumped the candy into a drawer, and took the bowl to the judge. The judge tore a page from her notebook, tore it again into 6 pieces, and wrote on each piece.
I have written the numbers 1 through 6 on pieces of paper, and I will now randomly select an alternate to take juror number 10's seat on the panel.
She folded the pieces of paper and dropped them into the bowl. She then swirled the bowl in her hand and raised it over her head. With her other hand, she withdrew 1 piece of paper, unfolded it, and read it out loud.
Alternate number 6, Brightman said. Would you please move with any belongings you might have to seat number 10 in the jury box? Thank you.
I could do nothing but sit and watch. The new juror number 10 was a 36-year-old film and television extra named Philip Kearns. Being an extra probably meant that he was an actor who had not yet been successful. He took jobs as a background extra to make ends meet. That meant that every day he went to work and stood around and watched those who had made it. This put him on the bitter side of the gulf between the haves and have-nots. And this would make him partial to the defense, the underdog facing off against the man. I had him down as a red juror, and now I was stuck with him. Maggie whispered into my ear at the prosecution table as we watched Kearns take his new seat.
I hope you didn't have anything to do with that story, Holler, because I think we just lost a vote.
I raised my hands in a not-me gesture, but it didn't look like she was buying it. The judge turned her chair fully toward the jury.
Finally, I believe we are ready to start, she said. We begin with the opening statements from the attorneys. These statements are not to be taken as evidence. These statements are merely an opportunity for the prosecution and defense to tell the jury what they expect the evidence will show. It is an outline of what you can expect to see and hear during the trial, and it is incumbent upon counsel to then present evidence and testimony that you will later weigh during deliberations. We start with the prosecution statement. Mr. Holler.
I stood up and went to the lectern that was positioned between the prosecution table and the jury box. I took no legal pad, 3x5 cards, or anything else with me. I believed that it was important first to sell myself to the jury, then my case. To do that, I could not look away from them. I needed to be direct, open, and honest the whole time. Besides, my statement was going to be brief and to the point. I didn't need notes. I started by introducing myself and then Maggie. I next pointed to Harry Bosch, who is seated against the rail behind the prosecution table, and introduced him as the case investigator. Then, I got down to business.
We are here today about one thing: to speak for someone who can no longer speak for herself. 12-year-old Melissa Landy was abducted from her front yard in 1986. Her body was found just a few hours later, discarded in a dumpster like a bag of trash. She had been strangled. The man accused of this horrible crime sits there at the defense table. I pointed the finger of accusation at Jessup, just as I had seen prosecutor after prosecutor pointed at my clients over the years. It felt falsely righteous of me to point a finger at anyone, even a murderer. But that didn't stop me. Not only did I point at Jessup, but I pointed again and again as I summarized the case, telling the jury of the witnesses I would call and what they would say and show. I moved along quickly, making sure to mention the eyewitnesses who identified Melissa's abductor and the finding of the victim's hair in Jessup's tow truck. I then brought it around to a big finish. "Jason Jessup took the life of Melissa Landy," I said. "He grabbed her in the front yard and took her away from her family and this world forever. He put his hand around this beautiful little girl's throat and choked the life out of her. He robbed her of her past and of her future. He robbed her of everything. And the state will prove this to you beyond a reasonable doubt." I nodded once to underline the promise and then returned to my seat. The judge had told us the day before to be brief in our openers, but even she seemed surprised by my brevity. It took her a moment to realize I was finished. She then told Royce he was up. As I expected he would, Royce deferred to the second half, meaning he reserved his opening statement until the start of the defense's case. That put the judge's focus back on me.
"Very well then, Mr. Haller, call your first witness."
I went back to the lectern, this time carrying notes and printouts. I had spent most of the previous week before jury selection preparing the questions I would ask my witnesses. As a defense attorney, I'm used to cross-examining the state's witnesses and picking at the testimony brought forward by the prosecutor. It's a task quite different from direct examination and building the foundation for the introduction of evidence and exhibits. I fully acknowledge that it is easier to knock something down than to build it in the first place. But in this case, I would be the builder, and I came prepared. "The people call William Johnson." I turned to the back of the courtroom. As I had gone to the lectern, Bosch had left the courtroom to retrieve Johnson from a witness waiting room. He now returned with the man in tow. Johnson was small and thin, with a dark mahogany complexion. He was 59, but his pure white hair made him look older. Bosch walked him through the gate and then pointed him in the direction of the witness stand. He was quickly sworn in by the court clerk. I had to admit to myself that I was nervous. I felt what Maggie had tried to describe to me on more than one occasion when we were married. She always called it the burden of proof, not the legal burden, but the psychic burden of knowing that you stood as representative of all the people. I had always dismissed her explanations as self-serving. The prosecutor was always the overdog, the man. There was no burden in that, at least nothing compared to the burden of the defense attorney, who stands all alone and holds someone's freedom in his hands. I never understood what she was trying to tell me. Until now. Now I got it. I felt it. I was about to question my first witness in front of the jury, and I was as nervous as I had been at my first trial out of law school. "Good morning, Mr. Johnson," I said. "How are you, sir?"
"I am good, yes."
"That's good. Can you tell me, sir, what you do for a living?"
"Yes, sir. I am head of operations for the El Rey Theater on Wilshire Boulevard."
"Head of operations, what does that mean?"
"I make sure everything works right and runs, from the stage lights to the toilets. It's all part of my job. Mind you, I have electricians work on the lights and plumbers work on the toilets."
His answer was greeted with polite smiles and modest laughter. He spoke with a slight Caribbean accent, but his words were clear and understandable. "How long have you worked at the El Rey, Mr. Johnson?"
"For going on 36 years now.
I started in 1974.
Wow, that's an achievement. Congratulations. Have you been head of operations for all that time?
No, I worked my way up. I started as a janitor.
I would like to draw your attention back to 1986. You were working there then, correct?
Yes, sir. I was a janitor back then.
Okay, and do you remember the date of February 16th of that year in particular?
Yes, I do.
It was a Sunday.
Yes, I remember.
Can you tell the court why?
That was the day I found the body of a little girl in a trash bin out back of the El Rey. That was a terrible day.
I checked the jury. All eyes were on my witness. So far, so good. I can imagine that being a terrible day, Mr. Johnson. Now, can you tell us what it was that brought you to discover the body of the little girl?
We were working on a project in the theater. We were putting new drywall into the ladies' room on account of a leak, so I took a wheelbarrow full of the stuff we had demoed, the old wall and some rotting wood and such, and took it out to put in the dumpster. I opened the top, and there this poor little girl was.
She was on top of the debris already in the trash bin.
That's right.
Was she covered at all with any trash or debris?
No, sir, not at all.
As if whoever threw her in there had been in a hurry and didn't have time to cover.
Objection!
Royce had jumped to his feet. I knew he would object, but I had almost gotten the whole sentence and its suggestion to the jury.
Mr. Holler is leading the witness and asking for conclusions for which he would have no expertise, Royce said.
I withdrew the question before the judge could sustain the objection. There was no sense in having the judge side with the defense in front of the jury. Mr. Johnson, was that the first trip you had made to the trash bin that day?
No, sir. I had been out there two times before.
Before the trip during which you found the body, when had you last been to the trash bin?
About 90 minutes before.
Did you see a body on top of the trash in the bin that time?
No, there was no body there.
So it had to have been placed in the bin in the 90 minutes prior to you finding it, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, Mr. Johnson, if I could draw your attention to the screen. The courtroom was equipped with two large flat-screen monitors mounted high on the wall opposite the jury box. One screen was slightly angled toward the gallery to allow courtroom observers to see the digital presentations as well. Maggie controlled what appeared to be the screens through a PowerPoint program on her laptop computer. She had constructed the presentation over the last 2 weeks and weekends as we choreographed the prosecution's case. All of the old photos from the case files had been scanned and loaded into the program. She now put up the trial's first photo exhibit, a shot of the trash bin Melissa Landy's body had been found in. Does that look like the trash bin in which you found the little girl's body, Mr. Johnson?
That's it.
What makes you so sure, sir?
The address. 5515. Spray painted on the side like that. I did that. That's the address. And I can tell that's the back of the El Rey. I've worked there a long time.
Okay, and is this what you saw when you raised the top and looked inside? Maggie moved to the next photo. The courtroom was already quiet, but it seemed to me that it grew absolutely silent when the photo of Melissa Landy's body in the trash bin went up on the screens. Under the existing rules of evidence, as carved by a recent ruling by the Ninth District, I had to find ways of bringing old evidence and exhibits to the present jury. I could not rely on investigative records. I had to find people who were bridges to the past, and Johnson was the first bridge. Johnson didn't answer my question at first. He just stared, like everyone else in the courtroom. Then, unexpectedly, a tear rolled down his dark cheek. It was perfect. If I had been at the defense table, I would have viewed it with cynicism. But I knew Johnson's response was heartfelt, and it was why I had made him my first witness.
"That's her," he finally said. "That's what I saw."
I nodded as Johnson blessed himself. "And what did you do when you saw her?"
"We didn't have no cell phones back then, you see. So I ran back inside, and I called 911 on this stage phone."
And the police came quickly?
They came real quick, like they were already looking for her.
One final question, Mr. Johnson. Could you see that trash bin from Wilshire Boulevard? Johnson shook his head emphatically.
No, it was behind the theater, and you could only see it if you drove back there and down the little alley.
I hesitated here. I had more to bring out from this witness. Information not presented in the first trial, but gathered by Bosch during his reinvestigation. It was information that Royce might not be aware of. I could just ask the question that would draw it out, or I could roll the dice and see if the defense opened a door on cross-examination. The information would be the same either way, but it would have greater weight if the jury believed the defense had tried to hide it.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson, I finally said. I have no further questions.
The witness was turned over to Royce, who went to the lectern as I sat down.
Just a few questions, he said. Did you see who put the victim's body in the bin?
No, I did not, Johnson said.
So, when you called 911, you had no idea who did it, is that correct?
Correct.
Before that day, had you ever seen the defendant before?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you.
And that was it. Royce had performed a typical cross of a witness who had little value to the defense. Johnson couldn't identify the murderer, so Royce got that on the record. But he should have just let Johnson pass. By asking if Johnson had ever seen Jessup before the murder, he opened a door. I stood back up so I could go through it.
Redirect, Mr. Haller, the judge asked.
Briefly, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson, back during this period that we're talking about, did you often work on Sundays?
No, it was my day off, usually. But if we had some special projects, I would be told to come in.
Royce objected on the grounds that I was opening up a line of questioning that was outside the scope of his cross-examination. I promised the judge that it was within the scope and that it would become apparent soon. She indulged me and overruled the objection. I went back to Mr. Johnson. I had hoped Royce would object because in a few moments it would look like he had been trying to stop me from getting to information damaging to Jessup. You mentioned that the trash bin where you found the body was at the end of an alley. Is there no parking lot behind the El Rey Theater?
There is a parking lot, but it does not belong to the El Rey Theater. We have the alley that gives us access to the back doors and the bins.
Who does the parking lot belong to?
A company that has lots all over the city. It's called City Park.
Is there a wall or a fence separating this parking lot from the alley?
Royce stood again. Your Honor, this is going on, and it has nothing to do with what I asked Mr. Johnson.
Your Honor, I said, I will get there in two more questions.
You may answer, Mr. Johnson, Brightman said.
There is a fence, Johnson said.
So, I said, from the El Rey's alley and the location of its trash bin, you can see into the adjoining parking lot, and anyone in the adjoining parking lot could see the trash bins, correct?
Yes.
And prior to the day you discovered the body, did you have occasion to be at work on a Sunday and to notice that the parking lot behind the theater was being used?
Yes, like a month previously, I came to work, and in the back there were many cars, and I saw tow trucks towing them in.
I couldn't help myself. I had to glance over at Royce and Jessup and see if they were squirming yet. I was about to draw the first blood of the trial. They thought Johnson was going to be a non-critical witness, meaning he would establish the murder and its location, and nothing else. They were wrong.
Did you inquire as to what was going on? I asked.
Yes,
Johnson said. I asked what they were doing, and one of the drivers said they were towing cars from the neighborhood down the street and holding them there so people could come and pay and get their cars.
So it was being used like a temporary holding lot, is that what you mean?
Yes.
And did you know what the name of the towing company was?
It was on the trucks. It was called Aardvark Towing.
You said trucks. You saw more than one truck there.
Yeah, there were two or three trucks when I saw them.
What did you tell them after you were informed what they were doing there?
I told my boss, and he called City Park to see if they knew about it. He thought there could be an insurance concern, especially with people being mad about being told and all. And it turned out Aardvark wasn't supposed to be there. It wasn't authorized.
What happened?
They had to stop using the lot, and my boss told me to keep an eye out if I worked on weekends to see if they kept using it.
So they stopped using the lot behind the theater.
That's right.
And this was the same lot from which you could see the trash bin in which you would later find the body of Melissa Landy.
Yes, sir.
When Mr. Royce asked you if you had ever seen the defendant before the day of the murder, you answered that you didn't think so, correct?
Correct.
You don't think so. Why are you not sure?
Because I think he could have been one of the Aardvark drivers I saw using that lot, so I can't be sure I didn't see him before.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I have no further questions. Chapter 26. Monday, April 5th, 10:20 a.m. For the first time since he had been brought into the case, Bosch felt as though Melissa Landy was in good hands. He had just watched Mickey Holler score the first points of the trial. He had taken a small piece of the puzzle Bosch had come up with and used it to land the first punch. It wasn't a knockout by any means, but it had connected solidly. It was the first step down the path of proving Jason Jessup's familiarity with the parking lot and trash bin behind the El Rey Theater. Before the trial would end, its importance would be made clear to the jury. But what was even more significant to Bosch at the moment was the way Holler had used the information Harry had provided. He had hung it on the defense, made it look as though it had been their attempt to obfuscate the facts of the case that drew the information out. It was a smooth move, and it gave Bosch a big boost in his confidence in Holler as a prosecutor. He met Johnson at the gate and walked him out of the courtroom to the hallway, where he shook his hand.
You did real good in there, Mr. Johnson. We can't thank you enough. You already have, convicting that man of killing that little girl.
Well, we're not quite there yet, but that's the plan. Except most people who read the paper think we're going after an innocent man.
No, you got the right man. I can tell.
Bosch nodded and felt awkward.
You take care, Mr. Johnson.
Detective, your music is jazz, right?
Bosch had already